Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stack Waddy Game, Mark, you've got one.
I've got one, which I've just written, and it's a bit out there, but let's try it, okay? Now, I was reading this piece, which concluded that Of Montreal, a band from Athens, Georgia, were, and surely this is a coveted title, the most pretentious group in history.
That's fighting talk,
isn't it? We wrote about them in Word. I don't remember them being that out of order, actually, but I had a look at some of their song titles, and it is richly deserved. So in a one-off pretension sound clash special, I give you song by the achingly affected rock band Of Montreal or artwork by Damien Hirst.
Very good.
Number one is, upon settling on the frozen island, Lekithin presents Claude and Coquilco with his animal creation. Is that the work of the Georgian songbirds or the bad boy of conceptual art?
Georgian songbirds.
It is. Thank you. It's from their album, Cocchio Asleep in the Poppies, a variety of whimsical verse, which they will kickstart any party. Absolutely sure. Okay, second one. The physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living.
It is Hirst.
It is indeed the cash minting paint wrangler. It's the famous shark, in fact. It's the glass painted steel, silicon, monofilament shark, formaldehyde solution, £7 million price tag.
To you.
Okay. Is this the work of the ostentatious guitar slingers or the gorilla sculptor? Beautiful Artemis, Thor, Neptune, Odin, delusional, sapphic, inspirational hypnosis.
It's your band Of Montreal.
No, it's Hirst.
Really?
It's gloss household paint on canvas. Isn't that bizarre? It's weird, isn't it? Okay, number four, the hopeless opus or the great battle of the unfriendly ridiculous. This is a musical interpretati. Overarching board treaders or irksome art merchant?
Overarching board treaders.
Yeah, it is. It is the mighty Of Montreal. They're extraordinary sometimes, aren't they?
Really.
Absolutely amazing. Okay, just got a couple more here, or three more. Authentic Pyrrhic Remission. Is that the elitist tunesmiths or the slappable dauber?
Slappable dauber.
No, it's the band. It's from their album, Paralytic Storks. Dear Lord, I know. Okay, some comfort gained from the acceptance of the inherent lies in everything. Flatulent troubadours or UK's richest living artist?
Flatulent troubadours.
No, it's her. Glass-painted steel, silicon, acrylic, plastic, cable ties, cows and formaldehyde solution. We have two to go. Schizophrenogenesis. The florid jongleurs or the irritating spiv?
Florid jongleurs.
No, that's Hirst too. You're right. I think it is Hirst. Yes. It's more stuff from their in formaldehyde. And the last one is Nicky Coco and the Invisible Tree. Overeducated.
That's Hirst. That's Hirst.
No, it's Of Montreal from the album, The Gay Parade. There it is. So
I came there.
It's an education, isn't it? That such song titles exist. Amazing. Yeah. So what a selection of toe tappers from Of Montreal.
Yes, I must put them down on my shopping list.
Yeah.
Alex, have you read about the story of Brian Robson mailed himself from Australia over 50 years ago? Do you know the story?
No, that's wonderful. Okay. Better than Ryanair, surely.
This is a guy who emigrated from Wales, I think, at the age of 19. And he went to Australia in the days when you could go to Australia for, I think, £10, didn't you? Can you mark it there?
Yeah, you go, that's right.
You talk about £10 poms, didn't they?
Yeah.
They were so keen to get people to emigrate. So he left Cardiff in 1964 when he was 18 to take a job It's got all kinds of interesting aspects. To take a job as a ticket inspector for Victorian Railways in Melbourne. And the idea in those days, you could, you know, apply for a job as a ticket inspector in Melbourne and then go all the way to Melbourne and get it, you know what I mean, and take up the job. Anyway, he didn't like it. Job was dull. That was the first surprise. Job was slightly dull.
I thought ticket inspecting would be endlessly rewarding.
He said it was difficult to make friends, which strikes me as slightly odd because Australians are very gregarious people, aren't they? I would have thought relatively easy, you know, to... But anyway, he also disliked Australia, which is kind of slightly unusual. So within a year, he decided...
Well, I don't know. Seeing as every unit of wildlife is designed to kill you very quickly...
That is true. That is true.
I can understand
it's
that.
It's a mild inconvenience for all the other advantages.
Yes, that is true. Anyway, he decided he wanted to come back, but he couldn't afford to come back, you know, because it was expensive and he had to repay the what it would have cost for him to get out.
Because he worked out that his annual salary and the amount that it cost him to live, that he would never manage it, would he? if he couldn't change his job, and he said, I will never get home. So, as you explained, Dave,
he saw an advert for Pickford's, the removal firm, who claimed to be able to move anything. And so he decided that he was going to purchase a crate measuring 36 by 30 by 38, just large enough to sit in with his knees pressed against his chest. And he booked passage from Melbourne to Sydney to London with the assistance of a couple of mates. Now, so far, so mad. Okay. And now he is 19 years old. Which he says in his defense many years later, because he's still alive, this chap, that he says most people are a bit stupid when they're 19. We'll park that for a moment, shall we? Because I think that's another podcast in itself. Anyway, he gets into his crate with his supplies, Alex. Are you ready? Okay. A hammer, a suitcase, a pillow, a liter of water, a flashlight and an empty bottle for obvious purposes. So he knows that he's going to be in this packing case for could be 3 days or something like that.
Got no sandwiches.
No, he doesn't want to take food.
That's good for us. No food, I don't think.
No, he's just got some water. And, because the idea is that water is the thing you need most. Presumably he feeds up first. But anyway, he's in there. His plan is that when he arrives at Heathrow, that they'll open the box and he'll be able to walk out and just merge into the people of London. The idea that he says there wasn't a lot of security in Heathrow in those days, but I like to feel that if he got out of the case, somebody said, hang on a second, mate, over here. Can just sit there for a moment while I get the police. But no, he thought, no. But
also, it's the idea that he's going to get out of the crate without anyone noticing. Presumably, the crate is going to have to be opened from the outside. Don't mind me. Just breeze past them.
Let me see. Anyway. It's London. Nobody bats an eyelid. If I just come out of the box, nobody's going to care.
This is what he says. I think it's because he came from Cardiff, I think. He said, go to that London, there's 17 million people in it, or whatever he thought the population was at the time. Then nobody will notice another one. Anyway, here's my point. He goes in the case 3 days, basically 3 days, takes a flashlight with him, yes, because he wants to pass the time. It's going to be fairly tedious, apart from freezing cold, boiling hot, and uncomfortable in all kinds of ways. So he realizes he ought to have some reading matter with them, Alex, okay?
Okay.
What does he take? The Bible? The Complete Works of Shakespeare? I don't know, The Lord of the Rings or some War and Peace? No, he takes a book of Beatles songs.
Of course.
Okay?
This is astonishing because this is 1965. There only are 50% of the available Beatles songs available at the time. And all he's got, presumably, is the lyrics, isn't he?
And he's sitting there. So he obviously thinks, well, I'm a bit bored. You know, I've been...
Nowhere Man.
I'll read Love Me Do again.
Yeah.
And he just goes, see how it turns, out.
Love Me Do. Don't tell me what happens at the end. Don't spoil it. Oh, I'll cry instead. Yeah.
I want to hold your hand. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand.
Yeah.
I want to hold your hand. It's absolutely amazing. So, you know, you clearly, I think it's fair to say, not the brightest lamp in the box in every respect. You know, going all the way to Australia for a job as a ticket inspector, which he expects to be really exciting, and then it isn't. And then posting himself back, and then...
In a box. And then the crate, in fact, does not go direct to London, does it? Doesn't go via Los Angeles?
Oh, well,
this can't be right. You know, I've read my Beatles book 3 times, I've drunk all my water, I've had a couple of wee's. You know, surely we should be there by now.
Are we there yet?
I know.
So, yeah, he arrived in Los Angeles and was kind of, he couldn't stand up, obviously, not surprisingly. He couldn't unfold his legs when he got out the packing case.
Was he flying or sailing?
Oh, flying.
Oh, God, sailing. No, that would be more than 3 days. No, he's flying.
Yeah.
Some of that is not just the flight. It's the sitting around waiting to be boarded and all that.
Amazing.
And he didn't get turned upside down and all kinds of appalling things. And anyway, they find him in Los Angeles. Some guy comes and peers in the hole that he got in his packing case and goes, my God, there's somebody alive in here.
That's right, yeah.
He obviously spends a few days in hospital being recovered. And there are
it's a Rubber Soul lyric book.
See, I don't want to come out yet. I've only got to Nowhere Man. I've got a girl in my life to come. I've got to stay and read a bit more. Yeah.
So the amazing thing is he was really fortunate that they couldn't do what they really should have done at the end of this misadventure, which was send him back to Australia, because they had no flights going to Australia or no spare capacity in that particular period of time.
The room in a hold.
So they got him on. They got him on.
Fresh crates.
They sent him to London, and he came. So he came back to the UK. And presumably just walked out into London and disappeared into a crowd.
It's an astonishing story.
So, you know, many years later, he's inevitably, like everything, there's a documentary film about this, which no doubt has a reconstruction of the box and so forth. And so now he's trying to trace the two men who helped him initially all those years ago. So
nail it shut.
So 19-year-olds, are they stupid? Were we stupid? Are they? I mean, what do you think?
I think 19 is probably when you hit peak stupid, actually.
I think it's peak stupid because you've got a bit of independence. You can travel to places. You can go on your own and you can go abroad and you can do all that. So it's exaggerated to the point of absolute infinity, isn't it?
That's the thing.
I remember my dad made a very wise comment about this once. my first cousin's son, rode across the Atlantic, I think in his early 20s, you know, which is an amazing thing to do.
It's
not really about stupidity, but it's about youth. And he said, he's either incredibly courageous or enormously unimaginative. And I thought that was a really good point, you know, because a lot of your 19-year-old self, your younger self, is not being able to imagine what might happen.
That's true.
You just don't think it's going to happen. It just doesn't even cross your mind that things could go wrong.
So who fights most wars? 19-year-olds.
Yeah.
As Paul Hardcastle, didn't he? You know, that famous one record. It's the average age of a combat soldier, isn't it? In Vietnam or whatever.
Yeah.
Was 19.
You've got all this freedom, this newfound freedom, and you think you know everything. You think you've figured it out.
Yes.
And you know, you've reached the apex of human knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem starts, really.
What's that saying about when I was 19, you know, I thought my father was the most stupid person I've
ever. Right.
Many, many years later, I find he's come on a lot.
Yeah, he's really changed. I can remember a conversation when we were at Kew about going to rock festivals, and there were two people there had been to the Wheelie Festival. I aged about 19, 18, 19, you know, and had gone without sleeping bags and without any warm clothes. It just they went gone in flip-flops with a bit of money. Do you know what I mean? And just suddenly it got dark and they were thinking, wow, I haven't got a tent. Everyone else has got a tent. You know, God, I wish I bought a jumper. Wish I bought some food. Help, this is a big grim. It had never crossed their mind it was going to get wet and cold and damp and miserable. I just think it's so funny.
It's the idea. It's the peak of lack of imagination.
I know.
It's a really good idea of your dad's.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
Well, it's the Grace Slick thing, isn't it? Grace Slick was on stage in with Jefferson Starship in 1978, which is disgraceful, because if it was 1978, she would have been 38 years old. But she made some terrible comment about the Germany. They were on stage in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember who won the war and all? Yeah. She was sacked from the band. And she said that whole thing about, really, that young people should be seen and not heard, and that old people should be heard and not seen. So that was rather a good point about old people. But then again, she wasn't very young at the time, so I don't know what she was talking about. Moronic. Have we forgiven her? I suppose we have.
Yeah, we have.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So, Mark, repeat the story. We were talking to... We're talking to Bob Stanley and Tessa Norton about their fall book the other day on a crowdcast, which is now available.
It's out there, and
they were very good. And you were telling the story. We were talking about Marky Smith and his drinking, and you were telling a story about how you observed this at close quarters.
Yeah, Select magazine. This was 1991, 92 or something. Select magazine were doing one of those round table things where it was him and Peter Hutton from The Farm and Mickey Berenyi from Lush and Andrew Harrison, and they were setting the world to rights. And so he turned up at this thing, and I don't know, we met about 1 o'clock in the Blue Posts pub just off Carnaby Street. He must have been there for about, I suppose, maybe three or four hours. Now, in that time, I seem to remember, because I was counting and I was so fascinated, he drank 11 pints. But not only did he drink 11 pints, he had a single scotch after each one, a little cheeky little chaser. And at the end of it, he seemed kind of pissed, but he didn't seem out of order or falling over or unconscious. Or I mean, I just couldn't believe it. But I suppose that's to do with just being match fit, isn't it? It's just drinking every day, year in, year out, and pickling yourself to the extent you can drink 11 pints and not kind of, because if you don't drink, I used to not drink in January, and I'd have a pint and a half on February the 1st, and I'd be high as a kite, because you've lost your kind of, you've lost your, whatever the word is, you're just not used to it,
Sea legs, yeah.
Sea legs, precisely.
So you see, because I don't think I've ever, if I think about it, really seen anybody drink that much. I've been in the company of people who put a lot away and did it regularly. But 11 is an awful lot.
It's an enormous amount. It's 2 an hour for, however long he's there, yeah. 4 and a bit hours. It's incredible, really.
Alex, have you ever seen drinking like that?
Well.
Oh, here we go.
A few years ago, I found myself hoiked in as the drummer of a 70s punk rock group. And these guys were all in their mid to late 50s at the time. And we did our first gig in Limoges in France.
All right.
And I meet them at Stansted Airport at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
the keyboardist and the guitarist are both there.
Yeah.
The guitarist is on the pints. The keyboardist is drinking his brandy.
And is it first drink of the day or is it first drink of the night? First drink of the day.
Six o'clock in the morning.
She's got to be having a brandy.
So, Yeah, the keyboardist is having brandy, the guitarist is having his pint of beer. Well, I think he has a couple, actually. We get to France and we have a lunch laid out for us eventually, and there's red wine and beer and whiskey all set out. And these guys are drinking non-stop all day. And I mean,
seriously?
Wow. All day. They just kept putting it away and putting it away. And I'm not drinking.
Did they play the gig in the evening?
Well, this is it. So I don't drink before I go on stage because it's just something I can't do it. So I'm just watching them and I'm just sort of racking up just the amount of the bottles of red wine and the bottles of beer and the bottle of whiskey and just everything that's going into them literally all day. We get on stage at 11 o'clock at night, right? They have been drinking, and I can't stress this enough, they have been drinking literally all day from 6 o'clock in the morning up to 11 o'clock. We do the gig. They play a brilliant gig somehow. They're fantastic. And then we go out afterwards and I start drinking then because I've finished and, I fancy a couple of pints. And I stay up with the guitarist who was carrying on after everybody else. And we go out to a bar together. And I have to go home after maybe 2 hours because I can't keep up with him. and he's out until 6 o'clock the next morning.
Where no, he's 24 hours. He's up 24 hours.
Jesus Christ.
He's fallen down a flight of stairs, cracked a rib, and he's still going. And this, apparently, was quite normal.
Good God.
Yeah.
So you see, because... Go on. Because I was going to say that... Isn't it surely the case that a lot of the people who... in music, who traditionally were most associated with drinking, was kind of part of their image in the days before we just regarded it as an illness, you know, alcoholism and so forth. It was kind of part of the rebel glamour of Keith Richards, wasn't he? That he had a bottle of Jack on his
Jack on his amps, yeah,
and all that kind of thing. Is it not the case that those people slightly pretended they drank more than they did? I was reading something about Sinatra the other day where people who were close to Sinatra said he never drank as much as he liked people to think he did because it was part of his image. He would have an occasional one. But
that was the whole thing, wasn't it? What did he say about Dean Martin? I spill more than he drinks or whatever it was. You know, there was a kind of rivalry, wasn't it?
Yeah. And of course, as we discussed recently, Keith has stopped nowadays, which is absolutely remarkable. If he'd really been drinking as much as he appeared to be drinking over the years, but I was going to say, surely people can't perform if they've drunk that much. But you seem to be saying on your experience in Limoges that they can.
Some people can. I think people have different constitutions. You know, I do not have the constitution to be able to do that. And I've tried. Don't get me wrong. I cannot do it. But some people can. And this guy especially, I mean, he was the band's resident alcoholic, basically. He was in the pub all the time. He's had to stop now because he had an accident eventually. It caught up with him, let's say. But, I mean, he had a good 50 years crack of the whip before it did.
I don't think it's possible. I refuse to believe it's possible.
Well, Richard Burton used to go on stage and play Hamlet, you know, and he would, whenever he went off, he'd be drinking whiskey, which is staggering.
Have
really.
You guys heard of Shitface Shakespeare?
Of what? Shitface Shakespeare?
Shitface Shakespeare. So it's a theatre company, and what they do, they obviously perform Shakespeare.
I like this. Plays,
but they draw names out of a hat, and one of them has to secretly get hammered. And nobody else knows who it is.
But surely you can tell fairly soon.
Oh, yeah.
What manner of town is this, milady?
Yeah. Is that my lord of Kent?
Yeah.
I
out,
say
out, damned spot.
Buy tickets to this thing. It's a proper really legitimate fun. Company. It's a great concert.
Very good
That's
idea.
That's brilliant.
Well, Richard Burton used to say when he... you know, because obviously word got around about how much he drank. When he'd start films, he'd say, I'm not drinking on this film. I'm only going to have a bottle of vodka a day. Because, you know, he reckoned drinking was two or three bottles of vodka a day. You know, one a day was abstemious.
Keith Richards, I used to look at Keith Richards, you know, he had a bottle of Jack didn't he, on the amps. And I used to think that either he doesn't drink very much of it, or is it possible that it's not Jack Daniels in there? Yeah. Or is it adrenaline? You know, because I can remember when you and I used to do the whistle test, when I first started doing that live TV, I was absolutely petrified. And you were just so rammed up with adrenaline. And we'd finish the show, we'd go and have our little after show. Do you remember, with the bottle of pee at door? Yeah. And you'd have a large glass of wine, and it wouldn't make any difference at all. You wouldn't be remotely affected by it. And another, and maybe another. And then suddenly, after about an hour, you'd relax, and the adrenaline would disappear, and you'd be feeling like you were hit over the back of the head with a baseball bat, you know. And I think adrenaline sees off alcohol, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, relax.
So that's possible. Yeah. But I refuse to believe that Keith Richards could have played those whole sets while swinging. I mean, you can't. You just can you?
Well,
can you get that kind of accuracy? Can you get that kind of detail? If you know,
I think your knee-jerk reaction is to think, "Wow, he's been drinking all day," you know. But Keith's quite a nocturnal character, isn't he? So he probably got up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He's probably had breakfast. You know, he's probably had a late start. That's probably his first second drink of the day.
That's true. That is true. And as I said, I did go to the Q Awards with him once, and he was completely sober and didn't drink at all. And then when he got on stage, did this whole act of going, "Here I am, where am I?" You know. And I thought, "Oh well, that's it. That makes sense. Yeah. This is kind of partly that is what people expect." You know.
Have you ever had? I want to ask you two questions. Have you ever had chasers? And have you ever had something that appears in 9 out of 10 American sitcoms or dramas that I see nowadays on the television? Have you ever had a shot? Because I don't think I ever have.
I've had a shot. Not many, because shots came in quite recently, didn't they? Shots was only it's a fairly recent invention.
Yeah, I went.
Imagine you will have had loads, I assume.
Far too many than I'm proud of. I went through a phase where the exact point where my night started to go wrong was when you had your first shot of Sambuca. You could trace it back to that one drink. Somebody goes, shots, Sambuca, and you go, yes, I'll have this sticky.
So the idea is it's a kind of supplementary thing to your basic drinking diet. You're drinking pints of beer or lager or glasses of wine, and then somebody comes along with this as an additional way of taking on board alcohol more expensively, more flashily, with less pleasure.
It's a notion that you're leveling up the night, or in fact, you're just leveling up your ratio of remorse the next day.
But that kind of drinking is weird. I can remember going to Russia for the first time. We were having lunch in a Russian restaurant with various people, most of them Russians actually. And they had this thing where, in Britain, it's a glass of wine, isn't it? You drink it at your own pace, and everybody very gradually kind of lifts off at the speed they choose to lift off at. But in Russia, they had between courses, you had a shot of chilled vodka.
Yeah.
And everyone got one, and you knocked it back. And it was like a very abrupt and very sudden gear change. Suddenly you were all kind of cranked up to the next notch, and you'd have your next course, and then you'd have another one. It's a very odd thing. So you were all, it was a totally different kind of drinking.
Well, in Austria,
a communal thing, actually. You were all
in Austria, they drink grappa. In Austria, they drink grappa between courses. And that's kind of meant to be a digestive thing. But
meant to be digestive. I love that. Yeah, it's good for the digestion. Yeah. The way we convince ourselves that. Apple spirit or whatever it is going to be good.
But Austrian fare is quite stodgy and rich, and it does get rid of a food coma. So it gets rid of any lethargy after a big meal. So it does kind of do the job. But with shots in the UK, what usually happened was somebody would with a wry smirk on their face just appear at the table with a bunch of shots, and everybody would go, "Oh, you devil! Oh,
yeah, why not
that time
What's
again?
What's the worst that could happen?
Oh dear!
Food coma is a new expression to me, by the way, Magic. That's good. They were signed to Creation Records, weren't they?
Two more from them after the news. Okay, so while we're talking about Bob Stanley and Tessa Norton and Crown Cast and so forth, the only way you can keep abreast of absolutely everything we do here, and we do lots and lots of things, is by being a Patreon supporter and making sure you get everything in full glowing colour and stereo sound, and you get it before everybody else. And so if you want to know about that, go to patreon.com/word in your ear. And I think we have some new patrons, do we, Alex, this week?
We are welcoming Christopher Ranger.
Christopher Hello. Ranger. Lovely. Nice to Come see aboard. You, Christopher.
Damien May.
Pull yourself up a chair.
David Burns and John Montagna, who we're celebrating his birthday later.
Oh, later on. We are indeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope he's got the shots lined up. John.
I'm wrapped up. Stuart Bryant and Douglas Green, who are both annual patrons, and you get 15% discount if you
subscribe. Right. Okay, so if you'd like to join them, patreon.com/word in your ear. Now, the vexed question we have to talk about. The whole nation is talking about why is the Mick Jagger Dave Grohl, do we call it a single? I don't know. It's a tune. Why is it so terrible?
I'm gonna put myself out on a limb here and say
I don't think it is that terrible.
All right, well,
I do too.
In his defense, explain it then. Go on, tell for those who haven't heard it.
We ought to say
a record. Go on.
We ought to point out that the lyrics are pretty shocking. It's about lockdown, isn't it? It's about coming out of lockdown, paradise awaits, and all that. It's sending up the cliches that people complained about during lockdown. It's all kind of I took a samba class. Yeah, I landed on my ass trying to write a tune. You better hook me up to Zoom. See my Ponzi books. Teach myself to cook. I mean, shooting the vaccine, Bill Gates in my bloodstream, it's mind control. So we've got to be honest, the lyrics are pretty lame. And also, I think a lot of people think that that's Mick Jagger, what Mick Jagger himself thinks, rather than a parody of the people who think that, you know. But I don't know, I don't want you to think of the lyrics, Magic, but I thought the tune wasn't bad. It's a 1978 kind of, you know, major chord punk rock song, isn't it, with a decent chorus? It's got immense amounts of
just,
pace.
Wait, first of all, what's it called?
All right. Yeah, all right. No,
say it again, Alex. Say it again. Mark, what's it called?
It's called Easy Sleazy. I know. I can't look at you when I say that. I know.
I can't look at the camera when
no,
it's
I
called
can't.
Easy Sleazy.
I know. I'm just trying to defend
There's
the
your
point.
It's There's not your point. Bad. You didn't even make it. You're embarrassed by it. And I, you know, I didn't make it. And I'm kind of embarrassed by it. I just think it's so lame in every respect. It aims low and it misses on every possible level. Lyrically, you know. And here's my point, Alex. Here's my point. It thinks it rocks. It doesn't. It absolutely lies on the deck. And all the whipping in the world and all the frantic activity does not enliven that thing one iota. If you played it in front of a room of, you know, 200 people who had nothing else to do, they would all go, what's that racket? Turn it down. They would not be animated as that record thinks would be the case. That's my problem with it. Rock and roll, most rock and roll nowadays doesn't rock. And that's a classic example of it. It doesn't engage you at all physically. And when and this is interesting because this is 50 years ago this week since that came out. And I know it's a long time ago, 50 years. That's the Rolling Stones Brown Sugar came out 50 years ago this week. And I remember, it's no exaggeration to say, when that came out, if you went to somebody's house with that and a couple of beers, you had a party.
Absolutely.
You just had a party.
Yeah.
You put it on, and people could not stand still during it at all. And I think, now I know this Mick Jagger, Dave Grohl record was not Rolling Stones record, and all right, fair enough, park that for a moment. But I think it's really interesting, a reminder of the fact that in the glory days of the Rolling Stones, they were a dance band. That's what they played for. Their greatest records were all records that people danced to. I know people find that hard to imagine nowadays because they think of dancing as something that's kind of done in clubbing, you know, environments and kind of electronic music and post-Bee Gees music and all that kind of thing. Well, in the 60s and the early 70s, it wasn't. You know, people danced to, you know, Brown Sugar. They danced to T-Rex. They dance to the Sweet. They dance to
the
Slave.
But the Stones have, I think, you know, and I agree with that. You're absolutely right. It's not a great dance track, but at least it's got some energy. At least it's got some fire. And I think it's been quite a lot better than some of the things the Stones themselves have done recently. But the things the Stones do is have various characteristics that give their music some kind of light and shade and punctuation and swing. And one of them is that they're masters of the offbeat, I think.
Yeah.
If you listen to Brown Sugar, Brown Sugar is on and off beat. So it's dam da 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 bam da 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 bam da 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 bam, and it's that offbeat that's really exciting. That's what gives it a kind of swing. They also have this trick where they go for a huge high note chorus. You know, Let's Spend the Night Together. It's a really good example of that. Let's Spend the Night Together Now. That high note is absolutely thrilling. But the key thing that they do, I think, is a sort of tension and release. And, Honky Tonk Woman's a really good example because it's, you know, I met a gin soap barroom green in Memphis. It's all very restrained. It's just little hi-hats. And then when you get to the chorus, but it's, it suddenly bursts out, doesn't it?
It does.
Suddenly a massive, great kind of feeling of release. You know, and actually, that's how dance music is kind of storyboarded, if that's the word. You know, that you get those 16 bars of kind of dropout, when there's that tension. You're waiting for something to explode again, and then 16 bars later, bang, it happens. You know? And the Stones really—I have to admit—the Stones really did have that. And that's a fair point that this new record doesn't have it. But is that a fair assessment of what they did?
I think that's true, and I think it's interesting also that if you think of the kind of, you know, the big party favourites, the big dance tunes, they tended to have a bit in them that people performed themselves when it came to that bit.
Yeah.
They all sang along with that bit, or they all did some
they
kind of...
They all sang along with the chorus of Honky Tonk Women.
It reached
waving the finger like Mick.
Yeah. It reached a bit that they could all do.
Yeah.
That they could all participate in. Whereas this clearly doesn't have that. And now, listen, it's not a Rolling Stones record. It just really made me cross. Because when it was posted on YouTube, I think the first of millions of comments was, and I thought it was the best comment, and it got there first, said, "Is this AI?" You know, because we had been talking about music being created by artificial intelligence. Yeah. And I thought, yo, God, that really does sound as if it's created by AI. They just run it through machines.
So write me a kind of punk rock song from 1978, you know.
Oh,
but can I just say one thing in Keith's, in Mick's defence, is that Keith Richards would never dare do any of these things.
No,
Mick Jagger,
that's true.
I know he fails a lot of time. He falls flat on his face.
But at least he has a go.
Keith Richards would never dare. Keith Richards has only done two things on his own, as far as I can see. One is he wrote a book, which he wrote with a ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was a kind of collaborative thing. The other was he put out a record called Talk Is Cheap, which was actually just him and a gang. It was Bobby Keys and Bootsy Collins and various people in whatever it was, 1988. And that was partly because the Rolling Stones themselves had looked like they didn't exist for a while.
Yeah.
In the 1980s, and he was clearly terrified that things weren't going to kind of last forever, and Mick Jagger had just made a solo album, and it said so he's pushed into it. But otherwise, all the things he's done, New Barbarians, Expensive Winos, they're just gangs of pals. Live Aid, gangs of pals. He wouldn't have got up there and done something on his own.
No.
Ronnie wouldn't bob down. Dirty Mac, you know, with John Lennon, Mitch Mitchell, Eric Clapton, whoever it was it that? I think it was, wasn't it? That's a kind of gang thing. He's never actually had the nerve to go out and do things on his own and stand up and be counted. I know that's probably rather a straight and orthodox thing to say, but I do admire Mick Jagger's kind of courage for doing it and risking his reputation.
Mm.
You know, Keith Richards is just, you know, Mick Jagger, we've said before, Mick Jagger kind of runs the Rolling Stones, and they're still... we hope, enormous. If Keith Richards ran the Rolling Stones, they would be the Pretty Things. They'd be playing the Hammersmith Odeon, wouldn't they? And I just admire him for doing that. And Keith Richards is just one of those guys who's always sat in the back of the class flicking ink pellets. You know what I mean?
All bands have that, don't they, Alex? They have that dynamic. There's always... And it's a classic case is Paul McCartney, John Lennon. Paul McCartney is always the guy going... I tell you what, why don't we do this?
Yeah.
And John is always the guy going, nah. You know, or being at the back of the class. You know.
It's yin and yang, isn't it? It's that equilibrium that is required for all things.
Yeah. I suppose so. We also talked this week to the guys here from the Nothing Is Real podcast, who are the proud holders of Ireland's Beetle Brain Award. Quite a number of years running, isn't that the case?
I think it is, yeah. They're really lovely guys.
They're lovely guys, and we had a really good chat about the Beatles, which you can find on the YouTube channel. And one of the really interesting things they said was that the difference between John and Paul was that John thought having the idea was the work.
Yeah.
And Paul thought, no, the work is the work. I thought it was a really interesting way of looking at all kinds of creative processes. Do you know what I mean? That there's always somebody who thinks the idea is the work, and it's not ever in anything. You know what I mean? Whereas when people look at it afterwards, they always look at it in terms of so-and-so had the idea. Well, all right, but you know, the person who did it was the person who did the hard work.
That's very true, because a lot of what John did, rather like Morrissey actually, is write fantastic song titles.
Yeah.
Once you've written a fantastic song called Instant Karma, or give peace a chance, or happiness is a warm gun, or whatever, then you kind of feel that the job is done. Actually, although in that case, all three of those are actually fantastic recordings.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true. It's the idea, isn't it, on paper?
Yeah.
God, that was a wonderful picture you found on Twitter. Was it taken by Linda McCartney of John writing the lyrics to Ballad of John and Yoko?
Oh, yes.
Paul's house, before they go to record it.
It was floating around on Twitter last night. It is amazing.
It's a fantastic picture. Absolutely amazing little details. Him and Yoko sitting on the floor. Everybody was low. There was no furniture in those days. You sat on the floor, low coffee tables, standard lamps, you know. It's terrific.
Because they were the only two Beatles on that song, weren't they?
They were.
Everybody else was away.
Yeah.
We got to stop talking about the Beatles. We can't go on. Oh, yes, we can.
You wait.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
There was that fantastic thing that you sent me, Dave, about... It's from an interview with Rob Lowe, where he makes the point that why be famous these days?
What's the point?
What is the point in being famous? It was really, really interesting.
Very interesting.
Because Rob Lowe, historically, has had his scrapes, hasn't he? It was a kind of sex scandal he was involved with.
Well, it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting to look back on that. And that was a big story in 1988. He was attending the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. And, Rob Lowe, fabulously good looking, was then, still is now.
Still is.
And, women, scraping them off him at every stage in his career. And on this particular occasion, he didn't scrape them off quite sufficiently and ended up being videotaped in his hotel room, having sex with a 16-year-old girl, which was over the age of consent in Georgia at that stage, which was only 14.
Yes, it wasn't actually illegal.
It wasn't illegal at all. And the illegality was the videoing. And that was the extraordinary thing, that the big story at the time was they videoed it. Yeah. Of course, nowadays, people video absolutely everything at every stage of their lives, you know. So you're not surprised to learn that there's a video. But clearly, it set his career back quite a while.
No, it did. It took him a long time to come back. Yeah, yeah.
He's come back enormously successfully now. But anyway, as he said, he was on Joe Rogan, the Joe Rogan Show. He said, what is the point of being famous nowadays? You can't have the crazy fun you used to have.
Because it's beyond that, isn't it? There's just so many aspects of it. You know, you get this feeling you have to sustain constantly your presence, for fear that you'll just be forgotten. I mean, there was the old album, tour, year off cycle, wasn't it? In music anyway, which worked perfectly. People would make a record, they'd be very, very prominent, they'd tour, then they'd disappear. And when they came back with something new, with a new record, with a new image, with something new to say, and you were really pleased to see them again. You know, you didn't need this this kind of constant presence from them. And also this idea that now you can exhaust your interest in anything by just burning through it on the internet. You discover a musician, you can just hoover up everything they've ever done, every interview they've ever done, you're not interested, and within a week you're tired of them. And as he was saying, any romantic liaisons you might have, the risk they could be documented.
Not just the risk. He says in the interview, he says they're lying in wait for you.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that's true. If Rob Lowe, very famous man, goes into any public place in America, there's a significant minority of people who would like to take some kind of picture that showed him in a bad light.
Yeah, exactly. Unflattering. Absolutely.
It just wouldn't happen.
And on a bigger scale, there's that idea that you are permanently on the edge of saying or doing something that will completely wreck your career, that will cancel you out and you'll never recover. I mean, that's a horrible, insecure feeling.
There's another side to this as well. Time was when being famous was a sort of, there was creative capital in there, in the sense that it was the mark of somebody who was really good at something. For instance, now, have you heard of someone called PewDiePie?
Yes. But only because I've tried to find out why he's so famous. He's the world's biggest YouTuber, isn't he?
Yeah, he plays games on YouTube, right? And that's what he does. And gaming on YouTube. Basically, what people do is they sit there with their headphones on and play computer games and comment on themselves playing computer games.
Yeah.
And they do this for, you know, 16, 18 hours a day. But it makes them really famous. And PewDiePie, for example, has got 109 million YouTube subscribers.
That's nearly as many as us.
It's almost not far off, word in your ear. But, you know, the fame paradigm has completely changed. It's not a mark of you being good at something anymore. It's kind of incidental. Surely that takes away the end game, the satisfaction of being famous. Because
I suppose so.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if that bothers the people who experience that, actually, because they've got some kind of, a collateral that they could exploit. But I can't help but think it's miserable. And also the level of celebrity is so much greater. You know, if you were in the 70s, you could be a rock star that was famous only to those small number of people who bought your records and might have seen you in a concert. But now you're ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And the idea of the iPhone too, that if you're walking down the street and somebody wants to take your picture, that's an incredible intrusion. You know, the idea that you've got to stop your day and allow that to happen. And if you don't allow it to happen, they will pillory you for not allowing it to happen.
Actually, it's funny because I saw a photo on social media this morning of Noel Gallagher in a supermarket. Somebody had clearly just gone up to him and asked for a photo, and he had a face like a smacked ass. I mean, he was not happy at all. Yeah.
Was he not wearing his mask? Because we were talked about this, didn't we, recently? That it was, who was it, Gary Barlow?
It was Barlow, which I thought was really interesting. Gary Barlow, you know, he gave his interview saying that actually he was really enjoying, this was the beginning of lockdown last year, actually, he was really enjoying the fact that he could go to all these places he'd never been before.
He'd
go to Sainsbury's, you know, he'd go anywhere at all with a kind of baseball cap on, maybe a pair of shades, and no one would have the faintest idea who he was. But that was really interesting. It also gave you an idea of just what a isolated life it is to be that well known. You know?
I'll tell you what, wearing a mask recently, because I went to the West End the other day, and wearing a mask, you know, out in public or whatever, draws your attention to the fact that you're robbed of the major means of communication that English men of a certain age use, which is a kind of nervous smile to each other.
Yeah.
It's just what you do. Yeah. There's a kind of apologetic smile, isn't there? It's what you do when you go into
shrugging, hopeless. We're both the same age.
I'm not really here to buy anything. I'm just kind of having a look, you know, whatever. And you don't have that anymore. You can be doing it behind the mask and nobody's seeing it at all.
That's true.
They're just seeing the
whole
passive
expression is muted.
Yeah,
we're evolving to expressing a whole new strand of eye language then.
I don't know. I'm not. Anyway, I was in the West End, and I'd been promising myself for a while that when I go in the West End, there's a few CDs I wanted to get. And so I went looking for them, not in a very organised fashion. I didn't exactly comb the West End. Although if you want to go and find record shops, even in the West End of London nowadays, they're few and far between.
They are.
They're hard to find. And anyway, I got some things this week. But what struck me was that if you go looking in the racks of CDs nowadays, under a kind of well-known established artist with a significant catalogue, which is most artists probably nowadays, you know, that they won't all be there, you know. And it struck me that the CD is just slipping away. And I thought I'd do a sense check. And I spoke to an old mate of mine who's involved in the record business. And I said, am I right that the CD is just going to disappear? He said, yeah, I think it is. He said, for a start, there's nowhere in Britain that manufactures them. Yes. And the other thing, which I never thought of, is there nobody that distributes them? Because that's what it used to depend on, was there were thousands of shops and they were supplying those thousands of shops with a certain number of new releases and then a certain number of, we need a copy of Hard Day's Night, two copies of Sgt. Pepper or whatever, were going in there absolutely all the time.
So the upshot is that they're going to be even more valuable, aren't they? Really appreciate them more.
I think that might be that might be the case. You know, I think that what clearly happens is that you stuff's reissued. But for instance, I got this week. This is three live albums by Hot Tuna, Mark.
I love them.
It's got Hot Tuna. It's got First Pull Up and Then
Pull Up, Then Pull Down. Yeah.
And then it's got Double Dose. So you can get the three Hot Tuna live albums in one 3-CD package. But you probably find it hard press to get those individual records, individually.
Yes. Yeah,
everything's reissued. Things are reissued with extra tracks or in really expensive versions. But the workaday, day in, day out, this is the catalogue. This is how it came out. I think that's going to disappear. And I think that's got to make a difference to the way we think about music in the fullness of time. Because people who collect nowadays, it seems to me, collect LPs.
They do.
Because they like them and they're big and they advertise
them. But that's an aesthetic thing, isn't it? It's what collectors buy. I suppose people who buy CDs are people who are wanting to buy or own the music that they bought to listen to and play, whereas you often buy vinyl because it's just a beautiful thing to have.
Yeah.
Play it, but that's a really unusual record. It's kind of some kind of rarity about it.
Yeah.
The thing about vinyl is that those sleeves had real character. They've got their coffee stains, they've got their cigarette burns, they've got the little name written on the corner that you wrote when you were at school, I don't know, all that kind of stuff. Whereas CDs don't seem to have that to me. They don't seem such beautiful things. And there's that risk that
They're absolutely. They're not beautiful. They're horrible in lots of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
But they are, the standard unit of buying a physical representation.
Yeah.
Of an LP, and artists still like to think and make an LP, don't they?
Yeah.
No matter how much people might, behave in a different way, the users don't always recognize that. But it's like this story about Taylor Swift remaking early albums. Because
that's a copyright thing, isn't it? She doesn't own the copyright to the very early ones, I think.
No, but I think it's also that if you make your version available for streaming, you can, your stuff will supplant the earlier stuff on streaming. What I mean? Because it's just out there. It's not that people are buying the new version. It's just that they're accessing the new version when they go and stream those tunes.
But ultimately, that's getting more revenue for her, though, isn't it?
Possibly. Yeah. But, I just thought it's really interesting because, that's a Charles Dickens book. Now, those Dickens books came out in parts, didn't they, at the time? Monthly parts or whatever. And then they were published. And ever since then, if you wanted Martin Chuzzlewit, there it is. You can hold it in your hand. You can go and buy it. Now, does the same apply, to James Brown's The Payback? If you can't go and buy it, if you can't go and get that thing and hold it in your hand, because it can float out there in the streaming world forevermore and people can really enjoy it, but they're not enjoying that thing. They're just enjoying access to loads of James Brown.
They're enjoying a random chapter from that thing, aren't they, I suppose? There's a section from it.
Yeah. And I think they are going to go up in price. And I'm not saying they're ever going to be the fetish items that 12-inch LPs are, but I think they'll be a lot more treasured than they are now as they disappear. Because that's what happens. Because, the era when all the LPs were in the bargain bins was at the time nobody wanted them because they all want a CD.
Because they want a CD, the CD alternative, equivalent.
And then, you go through a 10-year period where nobody gives a shit, and then suddenly, hold on. And I think we may be coming to the end of that 10-year period with the CD. So don't throw anything away, that's what I would say.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.